Hey, it's Tony. On today's show, we'll get a review of The Odyssey from Jason Fraley. We'll talk to Steve Sands about a television show he's involved in, and we'll talk some baseball with Buster Olney. But first, commerce.
Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Things are booming along pretty well with the tomatoes. Got the peppers going.
Yeah.
Early squirrel intelligence starting to appear. They're on the move.
Right.
So we're starting to set up defenses for that. I'm not home right now. I'm in Tampa, and I'm a little bit concerned that this is when they're going to strike.
So, yeah. Well, they know. They communicate that you're gone.
Yeah.
And then they go after it.
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
Much like yesterday, we are guest-loaded today, and we're going to get right to Jason Fraley. There is a movie out called The Odyssey. It's apparently a very big movie directed by Christopher Nolan, who's apparently a very big director. I haven't seen a movie in 10 years, so I don't know anymore. I know I read The Odyssey when I was in college, and I have a vague sense of what it's about. I don't know anybody who's in it. Nigel just told me who's in it, that Matt Damon is in it.
Yeah.
I tend to like Matt Damon. I don't know that Matt Damon can play a guy from antiquity, but he played a Martian.
Yeah.
He was believable as that, so maybe he can. Jason Fraley saw it last night at our request. He wanted to see it anyway, but this gave him a little bit of extra boost. How is it? What is it? How is it? Because I do have a sense that it has been controversial in the sense that it has not had a unanimity of praise, and a lot of people have said, whoa, what's this? What are we talking about here? So what are your thoughts, Jason?
I love that. I love the intro as always. I haven't seen a movie in 10 years.
Yeah, I haven't. So I watch sports. Hey, I watch the Nats. That's it. That's all I watch.
Exactly. Yeah. Hey, you're telling it like it is. You're being honest. Well, you know, it Christopher Nolan dates back even, you know, more than 10 years. Like, you know, I personally think he's like the quintessential filmmaker of the 21st century, like appointment viewing every time one of these movies came. I remember renting Memento. This is like pre-9/11 at Blockbuster Video, you know, so to follow his career from that to The Prestige to the Dark Knight trilogy. I remember seeing the Inception at the Uptown Theater, Interstellar, Dunkirk, and then of course most recently the Oscar-winning Oppenheimer was big Oscar crowning achievement. He sort of marked our time. So you know, whenever one of these movies gets released, you want to run out and see it, like on especially this on the biggest screen possible. So the Odyssey, I like you said, I just saw it last night. It's definitely another epic piece of work by Christopher Nolan. It's a piece of work, man. It's his first time doing a sword and sandal epic like this, you know, like the old, you know, Spartacus, etc.
Sword and sandal.
Oh yeah.
Oh, I like that. Sword and sandal. That's great. Go ahead.
Yeah. I can't take credit for that, you know. But you're, you know, like the old Ben-Hur Spartacus, Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah,
I guess
sure.
I guess since I'm a Jason, I should go Argonaut. Something like that. But But the technical craft is on like full display compared to some of those old, you know, maybe some of the CGI monsters of the classic ones that are a little dated now. But the technical craft here is truly on display. It's his first one he ever shot entirely on 70mm IMAX camera. So I made sure to go see it up here in Frederick at the Regal Westview in IMAX so I could get the full effect. And let me tell you, when that Greek god Poseidon is angry and the waves are crashing on Matt Damon's boat, like you feel it. I thought the theater speakers were going to come crashing in on me. So I'll probably go see it again to fully appreciate it. Like a lot of his movies, they're kind of like, you know, like tightly wound clocks. I like to go see them multiple times because some of it kind of, you know, it doesn't click for me on the first viewing almost every time. But the set pieces are great. The Cyclops, the CGI creature for the Cyclops is amazing and refreshing. And then the Trojan horse, you know, we all know the Trojan horse story. The Battle of Troy. I don't want to spoil it, but it's refreshingly different than we've seen before. It's not on like the big wheels rolling in. It's a little bit different. I kind of liked it.
Can I ask a question here? Because you have, Matt Damon is a great actor. But he's not a comic book hero actor. He's really not. Most of these large scale epic movies that have to do with, you know, thunder and lightning, use special effects that are not realistic. Is this realistic, or, you know, or is it a comic book movie?
I definitely wouldn't say, just because Nolan made the Dark Knight movies, I wouldn't say I wouldn't, you know, worry that it's too much of a quote unquote comic book movie if you're not into that. Like, okay. Like even on The Dark Knight, he was doing practical effects. Like they actually flipped an 18-wheeler truck with Heath Ledger there and Christian Bale. Like,
well, I'm only bringing this up because the Odyssey has been around for a long time. People know what it's about. It doesn't have Batman. It doesn't have Superman. It doesn't have flying people. And I'm wondering, you know, does it not have flying people, which is what I would like to believe.
I'm speaking your language. Yeah. Well, to me, you're saying is would Matt Damon typically flop into a movie like this? Well, Damon and Affleck made a movie, a Ridley Scott movie. Remember Ridley made Gladiator. They did a movie a couple years ago called The Last Duel, which was like an epic historical drama. I don't know if you guys saw it, but maybe that's what kind of wet my palate for to see. Okay, Matt Damon can do a movie like this, and here it's a pretty. I think it's a darn good performance. He has to play the stuff he juggles because it's jumping in time a lot. He has to play the younger, you know, Odysseus during the Trojan War. And it's kind of warts and all, too. We see that it's not just some heroic war hero. It's sort of a brutal attack on Troy, the women and children, etc. It's morally complex. But then he has to play the older Odysseus trying to return home and, you know, facing all of these obstacles. So he has to do a lot. Anne Hathaway has his wife, Penelope, waiting for him to return to Ithaca and fending off a dozen, you know, dozens and dozens of these suitors saying she can't take a new husband until she finishes weaving this shroud. And then one of those suitors, Robert Pattinson, remember from the Twilight movies, he's actually very hateable in this movie as one of her primary suitors. But Tony, it's interesting you mentioned the superhero. It is one of my two, the casting is kind of one of my two critiques of it. First critique, it's nonlinear, jumps around in time a lot, but the linear stuff we do see, it's kind of like a rock skipping across the pond. It's like, all right, now we're at the Cyclops, and now we're at the Sirens, and on to the next one. Mm-hmm. It's a lot mm-hmm. fit in this epic, mm-hmm. epic poem. But in terms of the superheroes that you mentioned, there's so many famous actors, even in the supporting roles, like, you know, in the margins of the screen, that it's almost jarring at first. Like, we get Tom Holland, who's been Spider-Man, to your point. As their son, hearing stories about the mythic father waiting to return. So he gets a lot of screen time, but there's barely any screen time for Zendaya. Lupita Nyong'o is Helena Troy, and she's kind of barely in it, too. Then you look over to your left, and it's Mia Goth. You look to your right, it's Elliot Page. And then Charlize Theron pops up as Calypso, Samantha Morton, Himesh Patel, Corey Hawkins, John Bernthal. And John Leguizamo does get a lot of time as a blind wise elder. I love John. But mostly, though, it's kind of got that... do you remember the greatest story ever told? It's talking of Sword and Sandal, a biblical epic, where it was like even the smallest roles were such massive stars, like Sidney Poitier shows up just to carry Jesus' cross, and John Wayne is the centurion at the crucifixion at the end, surely he's the Son of God. Yeah. Like, it was almost like, man, these people are so famous that... I don't know if we need to. It took me out of it a little bit in the beginning, and then it got going. And it does build to a powerful climax. I will say that.
I would assume. Well, everybody knows the story, but I would assume that great people, if they are in these smaller roles, that is a way to say to Christopher Nolan, "You're fabulous, and I want to be a part of whatever you're doing." That's what I'm assuming.
Oh, absolutely. It's almost like, okay, I want to hitch my career wagon to this filmmaker. Oh, absolutely. And you got to remember, I mean, he puts out these movies and they do huge. Like, no one, before going into Oppenheimer, remember the whole Barbenheimer summer with Oppenheimer and Barbie?
Yeah.
No one, you could have predicted Barbie would do big just based on it, Margot Robbie, et cetera, and Ryan Gosling. But no one thought that Oppenheimer, you know, you thought it would get critical acclaim about nuclear, you know, the science of a nuclear atom bomb. But no one thought it was going to, you know, be like a top five grosser of the year and all that. So, like, I think it's sort of, and it won Best Picture, which is sort of rare these days, the Best Picture and the blockbuster at the same time nowadays, which I kind of like. I love that. So I think after that big, it was sort of, Oppenheimer's the big crowning achievement. And so now it's like, oh, he's going to attempt the Odyssey. Okay, I want in. You know, even the biggest actors are like, I want in.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking these questions is because, again, this is a story that every English major has read and committed to memory and understands what it is. And I guess I don't want to see 8-foot-tall cats that, you know, that jump around and get involved in clawing fights, you know, because that would not have happened. I don't want to have to suspend my disbelief. I want to believe that this is a realistic portrayal? That's what I'm asking. Is it attempted to be realistic? In other words, the limits of what humans can actually do.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's some literary scholars that might take issue with some of maybe some of the liberties taken, but not with the creatures like you're saying. I think because a lot of this is a fantasy poem, so there is like some Lord of the Rings style esque CGI stuff that pops up, like the Cyclops and like etc. So it's not that it strays from the poem in terms of believability, in terms of like the creatures, but some literary scholars might take issue with sort of there's a part towards the end where I guess this is sort of where the Oppenheimer thematic through line comes through, where Matt Damon's character we kind of get to go in his head a little bit as he looks around and contemplates the moral dilemma of slaughtering everyone during the Trojan War. So I guess that's sort of Nolan reflecting on having just done a movie about Hiroshima and Nagasaki without even actually showing the devastation. So I think there is a little of that, and some literary scholars might be like, well, the original character and Homer might have been more tapped into, Greece is the word with Homer. Like, this is great Greek mythology, and he knew what he was talking about with the morality of all of it and feeling with the gods. But so I guess you could criticize. It's a nuanced criticism, though. I will say, it's not a grand slam for me. I'll probably go back a couple times. Like, it's not a grand slam, but it is a Homer, pun intended. Like, I had to go back and see Dunkirk like 3 times, and I saw Interstellar twice just to fully appreciate it. Like, they don't always click for me on first viewing in the theater. It's almost like overwhelming. But I will say it's one of the best of the year I've seen. I'd put this up with, if you haven't seen this, Project Hail Mary, Obsession, and The Invite. Tony, you might like The Invite. It's more Woody Allen for the modern era. Go see The Invite as well.
I've never even heard of these movies. I've never heard of. Listen, this is Jason, this is very good. Thank you so much for doing this for us. Thank you, Jason.
Absolutely.
Jason Fraley, boys and girls. You want to see it, don't you?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, remember reading it as a kid? And he's like,
In preparation for the movie, I've been going back and reading my college version. But it's interesting. The one that I read in college was the Fagles translation, which was the 1996. And then I think this one's based on the 2017 Wilson version, which has sort of a different understanding of the characters.
I didn't call out Jason on this. He said that he thought Christopher Nolan was the greatest director of the 21st century. And my immediate reaction was, Steven Spielberg. But most of his stuff
was
in the 20th century.
Yeah, his biggest,
So that's why I kept my mouth shut on that. But I do have a couple of minutes left to talk about the Nats. Did you watch, Michael?
I love that you're focused on the reality of a world where the gods walk down into our world and intervene in human issues. But let's worry about the eight-foot-tall cats.
So the Nats, they were up 2-0 last night, and the starter, who was just an opener from Meatball Mikolas, couldn't even get out of the second. They had to bring Mikolas in. He was down 4-2 when he left the game. And then C.J. Abrams had a couple of home runs, and the Nats either got to the lead or tied for the lead, and then they brought in Beter, and that was it. And a guy hit a home run, and they lose in Colorado. I mean, I didn't stay up for it.
No, but the guy who hit a home run is a
good hitter.
Bad, so, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Nats, that was a game the Nats had a real chance to win.
It's disappointing when you lose, when you have a lead, and against a team like Colorado, like, oh, we're better than these guys.
Well, yes, they are. Everybody is actually better
than
Colorado.
They had the lead for one inning.
Well, they
got it back immediately. Like, okay.
Yeah. They had the lead.
Did you watch any of the Dodgers-Phillies game?
I didn't. I watched this morning. I saw this morning the double play.
Did you see earlier the out at second that stopped the then tying run earlier in the game from getting home?
The Shohei. Well, he was out.
Yeah.
You could see it clearly on the replay. I did not understand. We'll ask Buster about both of those things, but Shohei was clearly out, and the run would not have scored, right? If he's out, well, if the run got home first, the run would have scored. But the guy sort of slowed down going home.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Shohei part, he was out. It looked out on live time.
Yeah.
I did watch that. Christopher Nolan, what else has he done?
Oh, he's done, the Batman series, the Dark Knight trilogy.
Yeah, but that's...
He did Dunkirk, which was fantastic. A space movie called Interstellar.
Is it stupid for me to ask Jason if we're going to see 10-foot tall cats jumping around? I mean, because it's a story that we all sort of know. Now it lends itself.
Okay, when you hear the Odyssey,
lends itself to that,
right?
Yeah, yeah. If you have the Cyclops, I don't want the Cyclops sirens to be 20 feet tall.
I think he's a big fellow, but
human proportions, just like Shaq, like larger, but not extraordinary in some way that it becomes comic.
Right.
That's what I'm worried about.
Right. Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm not going to see it, so I don't know.
What's so interesting, let me get it feels like here. These movies are designed for screens that are relatively hard to find versus just the normal movie that
that's
you go
what
to
he's saying.
Yeah, the IMAX. Yeah. Yeah.
If you have to see
but
everything
then you think
in
about
IMAX.
How much of the frame is then, out of vision if you go to see a normal movie or eventually you see it at home.
You're going to miss things.
Yeah, and I think I read this somewhere.
You're going to miss Shaq in the cameo as the Cyclops.
Great, Shaq as the Cyclops. Yeah. But I think there's something about IMAX cameras that they don't have the blueprints or the technology or the know-how to make anymore. So whatever is out there.
What do you mean?
Like whoever made them.
Somebody lost it?
Like they just, the people who made
engineer
them.
It?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I've read this on a couple of different
places.
Can't
just AI it?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, I'm sure.
When I look things up in my phone,
oh, you have to check.
It just says AI.
And you're like, no,
I don't want that.
Oh, no,
I want.
Well, maybe
I like
Eagle Eye
Athena
can come down and help us get a new theater.
I don't want this. I was looking up Tim Brown yesterday, and then it said AI stuff with Tim Brown. Like, no, he played his whole career. No, I actually want that.
Yeah,
they're ridiculous. All right, we'll get out of here. Steve Sands.
Steve Sands.
When we return, that's Steve Sands. Good. When we return, I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is Philip Martin. His first song is a song called Richie Allen Weeps, which means this is a baseball fan. We understand this. And he writes, really been enjoying the music you guys have been playing, especially fond of Gus Gustafson and Betty Sue, with whom I spent a few minutes when she passed through Little Rock opening for James McMurtry, son of the novelist Larry. Wow. I'm taking the liberty of sending along three songs for your consideration, two baseball related. The first is Richie Allen Weeps, which is really a meditation on the closing and demolition of Little Rock's Ray Winder Field some years ago. Its replacement, Dickie Stevens Park, is one of the best minor league facilities in the country and a short stroll along the river from my house. A line in the song refers to a great song about Allen by the Philly-based singer-songwriter Chuck Brodsky called Letters in the Dirt. And then later we're going to play a version of Wes Parker in Paris. I mean, these are baseball people.
First baseman, right?
Yes, for the Dodgers.
For the Dodgers,
makes me very happy. Thank you to Philip Martin, who plays in Steve Sands. The British Open is over by 3 days, because today is Wednesday, and yet I will always have Sands on, and I will always ask him to recap what happened. So what did you think of the British Open, particularly the Sunday, and how it ended, and who gagged and who did not?
I thought it was a great week, Tony. Royal Birkdale is so good. I had many, many players. I mean, like I had dozens of players tell me that Royal Birkdale is the best golf course in England.
Really?
And it doesn't get a lot of love like St. Andrews or Royal Portrush, for the Open Championship venues, Turnberry when it was played back in the day. But Birkdale is awesome. And I thought it was really good. I dig an underdog story. I love the way Ryan Fox goes about his business. Very quick player. I mean, really, really fast player. I wish every player would learn from him. I'm talking about from the grassroots all the way up to the professional level. And he's a really, really nice guy. He's got a great backstory. His father was a absolute stud.
Rugby star.
On the All Blacks, which is the most famous rugby team in the world from New Zealand. And I asked Frank Nabilo, who's a good friend. I was in the booth on Saturday when Ryan Fox was going to shoot 62. And Frank Nabilo is a real good friend of mine, as you know. Used to work with him a lot on Golf Channel. He went over to CBS. We worked together a bunch. We'll see him this weekend in Minneapolis for the 3M Open. And I said to him, Frank's from New Zealand and is a very big star back in New Zealand. And I asked him, what's Ryan Fox's dad like? Give me a little backstory on him. And he said he was a baller. He was just an absolute clutch player. And that gene clearly fell down to Ryan Fox, because he was money coming down the stretch. I don't know if anybody gave it up, Tony. I think Ryan Fox went out and won it. I mean, Sam had a chance. Others had a chance. Sam Burns, excuse me, had a chance.
Yes, so did Siwoo Kim. They had the lead on Sunday.
Siwoo Kim had a chance, but it was early when they, you know, got their bogeys. It wasn't like it was like giving them up real late. And I think Ryan Fox went out and grabbed it, Tony. I mean, he absolutely hit some great shots coming down the stretch on 17 and 18, especially after the bad break on the drive at the par 5 17th. And I mean, that drive, the second shot, and making that putt on 18, a birdie on the last hole to win a major championship, that's pretty money golf right there. I think he went out and won it more than someone else lost it.
Now, I'm not going to suggest he didn't win it, because four birdies in the last six holes and a birdie on 18, which had only yielded to that point 25 birdies all week. He won it, but those other people opened the door for him. I mean, Burns and Siwoo Kim opened the door for him because they had the lead on the last day and gave up the lead. I want to go back to what you're saying about Ryan Fox, who could play. He could play with the legends at Columbia when we play an entire round of golf in 2 hours and 50 minutes because we like to play fast. You can do that, but and I'll bring Michael in because Michael is a fast golfer. But if you're in a Sunday twosome and you're in the last group and one of your guys wants to unnerve you, he just gets deliberately slow because I believe, and Michael, you talk to this, I think fast golfers are far more unnerved than with slow play than slow players are with fast play.
Correct. Yeah, and that's why you see sometimes the walk in between the bag, pacing off a yardage, just trying to stay distracted. If you looked at him on 18, he was teed up, ready to go, looked like he was going to play through the group in front of him. And I think it was Scheffler earlier in the week was like, sometimes I think you were just playing a two ball out here because he's off on his own.
So what do you think, Steve?
He's one of the fastest players in the world. Now, obviously, he's world famous now, but he's won a couple times on the PGA Tour. A lot of people on the PGA Tour, you know, have known him for a long, long time to be one of the faster players. And for all the years I've been covering golf, the thing I probably hear more than anything else about the way the game is played, whether it's kids or at the highest level, but in this case, the highest level, fast players are way more bothered by slow players than slow players are bothered by fast players because it takes them out of their rhythm. And a lot of times, the better the player is who could be on the slower side, not necessarily a slow player, but on the slower side, they know that. So there's a gamesmanship aspect to it. Nothing's illegal about it. Nothing's wrong with it. Exactly. A deliberate player is a better way to put it than a slow player. And thank you.
Patrick Cantlay.
He understands he's a slower player than Ryan Fox. And if those two guys, not those two guys in particular, but if a slow player is playing with a fast player, a slow player knows that he can get under the other player's skin much faster, if you will, no pun intended, than a quick player can by teeing it up pretty quickly. Telling you, our producer, Tommy Roy, who is a world-class producer at NBC Sports, I mean, literally in the Broadcasting Hall of Fame, and we were like, this guy is so fast. Our producers, our camera guys, we were having a hard time keeping up with him because when you have two guys or three guys in the first couple of days in the same group, it's hard to go shot, when this guy's playing so fast. You know who else plays that way? Is Ludvig Åberg. We were joking.
Yes, he plays fast. I've seen
very, very quickly. If we were joking during commercial on the weekend that if Ryan Fox and Ludvig Åberg were playing in the final group, they might be waiting on every shot because they play so quickly. If they were
just
playing
together, through. Play through the people in front of you. Play through. Say, come on.
That's fine.
Play through.
I think it's a great lesson for all the kids out there who are watching. You know, kids watch professionals. That's what I don't like about. Now, I'm old, an old school, but I don't love it when guys are dancing after touchdowns or cornerbacks are yapping all the time whenever they make a nice play. Or in this case, in golf, when they're doing aim point or something ridiculous like that, because kids watch that. And now more kids are playing, unfortunately, slower because of this aim point and all that kind of stuff. Whereas if Ryan Fox, let's say he wins four of the next five majors, the kids will start playing quickly because they watch the pros and they emulate them. And I wish more players in this particular sport would play quickly as opposed, not fast, but just quicker than they play now, because this aim point thing is really slowing things down.
I was very confident that there was going to be a playoff. Very confident between Cameron Young and Ryan Fox. And then Cameron Young bogeyed 18, right? He's got to be punching himself in the head on that one because he had
and
that.
And it was a good bogey save.
Yeah, he had that in his grasp. He had the round in his grasp, right?
No question. But again, I don't think he choked per se. You got to remember, you know, Cameron Young made that bogey 2 hours before the other
guys
got to 18. The weird thing about 18 is, and it was just like 17, the thing about Royal Birkdale that I heard more than anything, other than the fact that it was their favorite course in all of England, is that it's the fairest of all the Open Championship courses on the Rota. And one of the things that makes it fair is that there are a lot of humps and bumps on the fairways, just like there are at every other Lynx golf course over in the UK. But they're flatter at Royal Birkdale. However, on 18, if you hit it to the right side, and 17 as well, if you hit it to the right half of the fairway, a lot of times those pot bunkers, those bunkers
you're going in
are
the
like
bunker.
They're like magnets, man.
Yes.
And
yes.
They are like magnets to those golf balls. And if you hit it on the right side of that fairway, a lot of times that ball would roll out. For instance, Ryan Fox hit he hits the ball a long ways, but he hit an iron, all right? That bunker is 326 off the tee. He hit an iron on 17 and that ball went into the bunker.
And it had to go out backwards.
It rolled and rolled and rolled. And it's just really difficult to navigate your way around Lynx golf. There are a lot of vagaries to it. I think that's one of the beauties of Lynx golf. But again, I know Cameron bogeyed 18. I know Sam Burns had a chance. I know Siwoo Kim had a chance. But I think Ryan Fox went out and grabbed
I'm
happy for him.
You had Morikawa and Rory and maybe Fleetwood, though you acknowledge the pressure Fleetwood was under. Morikawa was near the lead for the first 2 days, wasn't he? And then just
disappeared. You know, we spoke last week, and he was my pick to win. I just thought he would be great with his iron play. He's the best iron player in the world, and I thought that he would just overcome the other parts of his game and that golf course and win. And he got off to a good start, and then he gave a couple of back late on Thursday, and you just can't do that at major championships. You're going to make bogeys. You're going to make mistakes, for sure. But if you start making doubles or more, if you start going backwards, like Siwoo Kim in the middle portion of his round, and you can't recover, that's a problem. So Morikawa, I thought, had a really good chance going into the week to win. And he got off to a nice start, but he just couldn't get over the hump and then kind of hovered there in the middle, and then he was out of it.
I've got to go to DeChambeau because it's complicated. DeChambeau gets a two-stroke penalty on Friday and then holds everybody hostage by threatening not to play on Saturday, literally for hours. I imagine creating great enmity among his fellow players. Most of what I have read says that they all acknowledge that that is a penalty, inadvertent or not, that that is a penalty. They had no problem with it. Rory, of course, hates him, which makes me laugh, and just says, I don't like the guy, so get out of here, shut up, basically. But what are your thoughts on DeChambeau, on the penalty, on the way he acted after that, and the sort of karma of tripling 11 on Sunday?
So we go on the air on Thursday and Friday at 6:30 a.m. local time. It's 1:30 a.m. Eastern. And go all the way to the finish, which is usually around 8:45 p.m. So those are a couple of long days. You would have loved this, Tony. It's a very quick TV thing, but I know you so well, you would have loved this. So the DeChambeau thing happens late. He's in one of those featured groups late on Friday. And all the craziness happens. He doesn't sign his scorecard. We realize something is going on, and we stay on the air. Well, who knew we were going to stay on the air for another hour, 20 minutes, because he literally took the event hostage. Goes out to the fifth hole. And he's got his caddy there. That's perfectly fine because he's stating his case, trying to, you know, beg to not get the two shots. He was going to get the two shots the whole time. The RNA told us that, you know, it wasn't up to the player at this point. It was up to them. And what they saw was what everybody else saw, which was he deserved a two-shot penalty. Inadvertent or not, by the way, the agent was out there and the swing coach was out there. Like, what are you doing, Bryson? Like, get off the stage. It should be just the player and the caddy. It should not be the agent and the swing coach and all that kind of stuff. But that's part of the show that is Bryson DeChambeau. It's part PGA Tour, part Live, part Major Championship Golf, part WWE is what you get, you know, from Bryson DeChambeau. The penalty was deserved, Tony. You know, here's why. All the professionals who were texting and talking to us the entire time, and including the two guys to my left in the booth, Kurt Byram, who's a PGA Tour winner, and Jim Furyk, who accomplished player, won the U.S. Open. They both knew it right away, and here's why. When professional golfers hit a ball into the situation that Bryson did, they don't walk in there like an elephant. All right, amateurs do that. They walk in there gingerly. All right, and I'm not saying it's inadvertent or not. I don't know. I can't get into the mind of Bryson DeChambeau. All I can tell you is between the two analysts who were in the booth with me at the time when it was going on and every other golfer I know at the highest level who was texting in, they were like, hang on a second. Whether he did it on purpose or not, when you walk into a situation like that, like an elephant, and you're moving around bushes and weeds and impeding things that would have probably impeded your backswing, you're improving your lie, inadvertently or not. That's something an amateur would do. So when we saw it live on the fifth hole, we didn't think anything of it. But Jim and Kurt did, because they see it differently than people like me and you, Tony. Yeah. They're professionals. You know, we're amateurs. And they knew. They were like, wait, that doesn't look right. And it was an automatic two. It should have been two. He got the two. And, you know, the threatening to not play the next day and the theatrics, you could argue back and forth whether that's good or bad. I don't know. Is it good TV? Is it bad TV? Is he showing off? Is he trying to get out of it? Who knows? But it's part of the Bryson DeChambeau circus. But for sure, he deserved the two-shot penalty.
Okay.
Every professional golfer I spoke to, every single one of them was like, whoa. Not that he meant to do it, per se, because you don't know that for sure. But for sure, he walked in there, and that is a two-shot penalty. You cannot do that. That is something that you and I would do. You know, that is not something professional golfers do.
I would also identify my ball and put it up so that I could hit it, but that's why I don't do this for a living.
You know what's really strange about that scenario? That what happened just before that, this is live on TV, so you never know what's going to happen, but when he hit his tee shot all the way to the right, it was a short, drivable par four. Very cool hole. Very cool hole. And he hit it way to the right. He then teed it up quickly and hit a provisional. And now that rule I do know. You know, we've got to know the rules. It's part of our job. Yeah. You can't hit a provisional if you hit the ball in a penalty area. And we thought, uh-oh, that's going to be the penalty, not the other. And at the time when it happened live, again, this is live, so you don't really know what's going on down there. Then we were notified just before he hit the provisional, he was told by somebody, a marshal or somebody out there, they radioed it back to the tee that the ball was not in the penalty area so that he could hit the provisional in case they couldn't find it. So there was a lot going on there, but without question, Tony, he deserved the two-shot penalty. Whether he liked it or not, that was a two-shot penalty for sure.
All right, I'll get you out of here on this.
Let me give you another interesting scenario. If that was Sunday, I was telling Val Sands this yesterday. If that
Val
was Sunday,
Sands.
they would have notified him on the fifth hole.
Yeah, right then and there. Yeah,
because if you have a one shot lead on 18, you're going to play the golf. You're going to play that hole differently. On Thursday, Friday, Saturday,
they don't have
people who are wondering why they didn't notify him until after his round before he signed his scorecard. You do that on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, but in the final round on Sunday, strategically, you would play perhaps differently on the back nine, especially late if you're leading or you're one back, one or the other.
Sure.
And that was another part of the scenario that people were trying to figure out why they were not telling him. That's the reason they didn't tell him, because Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, you can wait till the end. Sunday, you can't wait till the end. That's not fair to the player.
All right, to get you out of here on this, and it's I buried the lead. Are you in a show called The Hawk with Will Ferrell? Are you in the show?
Yes,
are you in the show? People tell me this is a very funny show. My daughter watched the first season, said it was really funny.
Yeah, I was. I got a call. I got a call late last year, and I figured, excuse me, I figured it was like a friend of mine just messing with me, asking to come out to L.A. and do a cameo for the show. It was a lot of fun. Got to meet Will Ferrell. Could not have been a nicer guy. Luke Wilson's in it. Could not have been a nicer guy. We were talking about all kinds of stuff, Hollywood, golf, sports, life, family. Spent the day out there. Molly Shannon, a couple of other actors and actresses who you would recognize, people would recognize her in it. It was an amazing experience. I still don't understand why they called me. But it was a lot of fun.
That's great.
And they're good people. And it is amazing to see how the sausage is made, if you will, how those kinds of things are done. It was a very, very cool experience. And man, I was telling Val Sands this yesterday, actually, again, the power of Netflix and the power of Will Ferrell. I've gotten more texts from people I haven't heard from in years about this show. And I'm like, okay, I haven't seen it. I'm not into Googling myself or watching myself, but it was a fun experience, Tony. It was very cool.
That's great. Yeah, no,
could not have been a nicer guy.
It's fun, and you're going to get residual checks for the rest of time. So that they may only be for 27 cents
still,
but you're going to get it for the rest of the time.
I actually
glad you had a good time.
I actually think it's going to be 26 cents. Yeah.
Okay.
And by the way, can I just say one thing? Can I say one thing? Because I know he's listening because he listens to every show just like me. Was out in Tahoe for the American Century Championship and ran into Greg Garcia, obviously. We chatted. Yeah. We had a great time. We were having a lot of fun. We were hanging out. And then I saw his act on Saturday. Tony, he warmed up for Nate Bargatze, and Ray Romano was on stage as well. You're talking about Nate Bargatze is a first ballot Hall of Fame comedian. Ray Romano, even though he's past his prime, is a first ballot Hall of Fame comedian. Greg Garcia got up there. Now, I'm good friends with Greg, and I love Greg, and the show loves Greg. But let me tell you, to watch him do that in person, on stage, that's got to be the most difficult thing to do in all of entertainment. To quote Bill Raftery, the onions it takes to do that. I mean, my God, it was incredible. And, I mean, I know he's funny. We both know he's funny. We all know he's funny. But to do it like that... It's incredible, man. I was in awe of our good friend Greg Garcia. I thought it was amazing to see
that's
it.
Great.
And my God, is he funny, Tony. Jeez.
Between you and Alan Bubis, you know everyone in the world. Everyone in the world. You and the socialite, you know them all.
What are you talking about? We all know Greg Garcia. What are you talking about?
I know, but I'm saying you know everybody, though. You know everybody. Everybody comes up to me and says, oh, Sands is here, or Sands was there, or Sands is doing... Yeah, everybody knows Sands. All right, enjoy, Minnesota?
You're so full of it, Tony. It's unbelievable.
You and Alan know everybody. And you know Alan, and he knows you. It's wonderful.
By the way, right. Alan Bubis. I love Alan Bubis, man. I want to be Alan Bubis.
What did you say?
That great line?
It's two questions.
You gave me a great line. That's what it was. What is it?
He has to answer two questions every day. Where am I playing, and what's for dinner? And that's it.
That's all.
That's
a great line.
Enjoy
and
yourself.
If anybody does not aspire to do that, you're out of your mind. Heading to Minnesota for the fifth major, the 3M Open.
Yeah, enjoy.
And then,
sixth major.
For a couple of weeks. We'll have to get together and play a little golf, have some dinner, have a drink.
Yeah, we'll go to Rehoboth. All right, be good.
On your account.
Boys and girls. Yeah, it's fine. Everybody else is on it. You can be on it.
Just give me Kornheiser 3711. Thanks.
Buster only when we return on Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Once again, this is Philip Martin, who we like very much.
Oh, yes.
This song is called West Parker in Paris. Song inspired by his friend, former colleague, and Washington Post feature writer Michael Leahy's book on the L.A. Dodgers, The Last Innocence. The bass player Randall Berry contributes some very shy backing vocals on the track. He's expendable if Tony ever wants to come out of retirement. Michael, if people like Philip Martin want to send in their original music, how do they do it?
Send us your music by emailing it to jingles@tonykornheisershow.com.
And this segment with Buster Olney is brought to you by FanDuel. Play your game. There's a lot of things to talk about with baseball as we resume baseball. I think we need to start small. We need to start with that double play last night with the Dodgers.
Oh, boy.
What? So JT Realmuto takes complete responsibility for it. But what do you think he's even thinking when he tries to go back to second base when he is safely on third? What is he thinking?
I think in an instant, you know, with the play going in front of him, he's thinking Justin Crawford might be able to extend the pickle, right? And maybe he gets out of it. He's Carl Crawford's son. His speed is breathtaking. And JT just, I think, kind of lost his mind for a second, thinking that Justin was going to merge. Now, that's the only explanation I had. And JT, as you know, is one of the great pros. And it doesn't surprise. He probably was waiting for reporters to come through the door to stand in front of his locker and say, yep, you know, brain fart, terrible move by me. I mean, that's in keeping with who he is.
Yeah. I think so. I also have to go to the Red Sox. They were rained out last night. They've won 13 or 14 in a row. They are upsetting the apple cart on every level, including the trade deadline, because nobody knows what's going on with them. What do you make of the Red Sox? They made a managerial switch early. They brought in another guy who had no particular salutary effect on the team for a month or two, but now something is going on there. What is going on?
Yeah, and Chad Tracy, you know, the son of former Major League manager Jim Tracy. You know, Chad Tracy, who, you know, was drafted, he played in the minor leagues for years, but he never got to the big leagues until he was hired, offered the job by Craig Breslow when Alex Cora was fired. And the team is responding. I think the primary reason, of course, is the pitching. You know, for all the criticism that, you know, folks like me have given Craig Breslow about leadership and how do you build a team without power, he focused on pitching, and the pitching has manifested. Their bullpen has an ERA just over one since this winning streak began. And let's face it, Tony, it's the American League. It stinks. It's so wide open that you could see a team that could make a run like this. And the funny thing is because the Red Sox have surged forward, they're now in the third wild card spot. It has totally complicated the equation for the Detroit Tigers, who now have drifted backward to five games out in the race for the third wild card. They're not making up ground because the Red Sox are winning every day.
And they are doing it without Roman Anthony, without Story, without Crochet. I mean, these are the three of their five highest paid and most highly regarded players, right? They're not there.
And those guys are, you know, they're not coming through the door anytime soon. Crochet has not started his throwing program. Anthony has this, this very touchy injury with his hand. He's not coming back anytime soon. They're making it work and I think forcing probably ownership to consider something it may not have even thought was possible a month ago, and that's to actually be buyers before the trade deadline to go out and get the right-handed hitter they so desperately need.
I am familiar with Tarek Skubal's contract situation. He is about to become a free agent. So if you trade for him and you can't sign him, you are renting him for 2 months. Mason Miller is a fabulous reliever. Do you expect both these people to be moved?
I think the Tigers are on an absolute on the fence. I mean, just hanging in there. I loved what A.J. Hinch, their manager, said the other day about their games right now. They're playing game seven every day.
Yeah, he said that. Yeah,
now and the trade deadline. And I think that's 100% right, where, you know, on Saturday when they won, I was on SportsCenter and I said, look, they're playing at 102-win pace since the beginning of June. But you know what? Now they lost on Sunday and they lost last night. And their playoff odds, according to Fangraphs, are down to 28%. If they don't make up ground here in the next 10 days, yeah, he's going to be traded. And a team like the Braves or the Tampa Bay Rays or, you know, maybe the Phillies, they'll be the team to make that move. And Mason Miller, I had a GM say to me last night, he thinks the Padres are going to trade him. This is the best closer in baseball. 0.89 ERA. He struck out 48% of the batters that he's faced. I'm looking at the Yankees, and I'm looking at the Seattle Mariners being potential buyers there. We know this. A.J. Preller, their general manager, the person I talked to yesterday, said he loves to transact. You know, where he acquired Juan Soto, and then he wound up flipping Juan Soto a year and a half later to the Yankees. Brian Cashman, Yankees GM, A.J. Preller, they've made that big deal before. Maybe they do it again.
Oh, everything is day-to-day now because baseball is played every single day. Last night, Machado hit two home runs. Tatis hit a home run. If I sat there and I ran the Padres, I might say, well, I'm not trading a closer if my guys... If we can get what we expected all year and haven't gotten to this point, we can win, right? Does that go into that mindset?
Yeah, it's so interesting when you talk to GMs, and not necessarily AJ Preller when you have this conversation, but a lot of GMs will actually quote their playoff odds. You know, it'll be like, hey, yeah, we won the last two games. Our chances are up to 29%. Maybe that moves us in the other direction. The Padres' chances for making the playoffs, because the National League is so much better than the American League, as of this morning, is 11.8%. Those wow. numbers aren't good. So if if the Tigers are playing Game 7, then where the Padres are is Game 7, bottom of the ninth inning, down two yeah. runs. Like, yeah. they have to turn it around right now.
Let us get to the two best players in baseball who are not necessarily playing at 100% now. One isn't playing at all, Aaron Judge. I think he's eligible to come back in about 5 or 6 days, but that doesn't mean he can come back physically. And Shohei Ohtani, who it's half a loaf at the moment. He can hit, and you want him to hit, but he's not pitching at the moment. Well, how does that complicate races, and how does it complicate maybe the MVP balloting in both leagues?
So with Aaron Judge, the Yankees, they expect he's going to play again this year, but they have no idea exactly when that's going to be. Maybe it's, late August, early September, and they don't know how he's going to be when he comes back and how he's going to hold up. They know he's not going to be completely healed when he comes back. So they'll just, try to upgrade the team and try to play well enough to get into the playoffs, and then they'll see what they get with Judge when he returns. I think the same situation is with Giancarlo Stanton, their DH. And with Ohtani, the other day when we talked to Dave Roberts, the Dodgers manager, we had the Dodgers on TV on Monday night. He told us that Ohtani is likely to throw a bullpen session this weekend, and then he might pitch 2 or 3 weeks after that. This is classic Dodgers. They're slow playing their injuries. They're doing it now with Blake Snell, Tyler Glasnow, now Shohei Ohtani, because the message is we want to make sure you're right in October, but you are 100% right. I think it completely opens up the NL MVP conversation because Ohtani's preeminence is based on the fact that he's a two-way player.
Yeah.
We don't know if he's going to be able to be that as he goes forward. And Pete Crow Armstrong of the Chicago Cubs is a great two-way player, his two-way being offense and defense. He's got 21 homers, 25 steals. He's on a pace to get on base more than 250 times this year. He also is tied for the major league lead in outs above average, a great defensive metric. Craig Counsell's told me he's the best defensive player in baseball. So if he continues to be on the current trajectory and continues to play defense, yeah, I think it's going to be a coin flip in the MVP race when we get to the end of the year.
And he's from that same high school, right? Harvard Westlake in L.A. that has produced so many major league pitchers in the last 5 years, right?
He is the cautionary tale in baseball now about giving up prospects at the deadline. You remember the Cubs got him for 2 months of Javier Baez,
right?
deal with the Mets, and that now scares all these teams. It's why when we get to this time of year, they're not willing to give up their very best prospects.
All right, you mentioned doing the game the other night. A dear friend of ours, Carl Ravitch, is close to you. He's a friend of mine, but he's, I'm sure, a closer friend to you, and you'd like to talk a little bit about him, I think.
Yeah. Tony, we worked 23 years together at ESPN. I got to do tons of baseball tonights and Sunday night baseball in recent years. People ask me all the time, who do you root for? And I always say I root for good stuff to happen to good people, and that's why it just hurts. Carl, every game that I ever worked with him, every show, 100% passion, always prepared. Love the job. The other night we're in Dave Roberts' office and, we're joking around and stories are being told. Dave said afterward, boy, that was a great, rounder. It's his, Carl just has brought it every single day and I have loved working with him. So it was really, really just heartbreaking to get that news yesterday.
Yeah. He can also drive it 280.
Really?
No, he's a good golfer.
Can he plant potatoes, though?
I don't know if he can plant potatoes. So, yeah, I feel the same way. I think he's really, really good. Thank you, Buster. This segment with Buster Olney has been brought to you by FanDuel. Play your game. And we'll be back with email and jingle.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Here comes Tony's mailbag. She's gonna read some for all of you.
I love that. That's Pat Baz. I really love that.
That's a good one.
You want to do the Bethesda Bagel ad, please?
Yes, Bethesda Bagels. We love them. You would as well. Just go to BethesdaBagels.com for the location in the D.C. area near you. Then pop on in and you'd be thrilled. And got a quick word from Lee Gordon from Boynton Beach.
Yeah.
Sending a reminder that the Summer of Littles is back on Saturday, August 1st. He is going to be co-hosting this year at the Yard House at Misner Park in Boca Raton starting around 5 p.m. Wants to give a shout-out to Bob Welsh for creating the Summer of Littles and Toby Clark for picking up the torch, but looking forward to see everyone there on August 1st.
Well, if it's in Boca, I hope my friend Jody goes. Yeah. Hope Jody and Nancy go. That would be good. All right, before we get to the mailbag, let me just say, Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one, but I know that you've got your reasons. These things that are pleasing you can hurt you somehow. That's written and sung by Don Henley, whose birthday is today. He's 79 years old today, and he's still great.
Yes.
He's great.
Yes.
Thanks to our guests today, Jason Fraley, Steve Sands, Buster Olney. Thanks as well to today's sponsors. Remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Odyssey. Get the show through Apple Podcasts. Please leave us a review. Let me say to Sean Pleskina at Bill's Ace Hardware in Arlington, Virginia, this is the greatest offer in the history of the world. I'm not going to go line by line on this, but it's very, very, very kind of you. And we put that in the special pie.
Very special
pie. I might stop by the store. I need to get some replacement enameled cast iron grill grates for a Summit 400
series. So there you go. Talk to him.
This is across the street from Cowboy Cafe, a restaurant that I've not been to in 25 years.
Well, go.
Yeah.
If it's across the street, go.
And down the street from the most expensive diner.
Oh, okay. from Felipe Gatica in Santiago, Chile. A few thoughts on the World Cup final. Argentina and the dark arts. What Paredes did isn't surprising. It's culture. Growing up playing soccer in South America, you're raised on aguante, a culture that values honor and guts over pure football. You go in swinging, you threaten, you risk everything, even against the odds, because backing down matters more than losing clean. Bad losers by design. Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, the Atlantic bloc genuinely don't know how to lose. Part of it is the culture above, but part of it is much simpler. They've won so much for so long in this part of the world that losing has become an anomaly, and they won't accept it easily. On Wilbon, wanting stars like Bellingham and MLS won't happen soon. Glory still lives in Europe. That's still the biggest stage in the sport. The model MLS should actually watch is the Saudi League, legends arriving at the tail end of their careers, not their prime. For Taylor Twellman, I'd love his take on U.S. academies. American kids get to stay in school and still develop athletically, while soccer almost everywhere else forces an early either-or between football and school. In his view, is that trade-off part of what keeps American players from reaching the next level? Best World Cup I've watched in my 40 years of following the sport. Thank you for the space, Dr. Tony. Isn't that nice?
That is lovely.
Very, very nice. Yes. And on the heels of that, from Mark Siegel in Seattle, on the day before the FIFA World Cup crowned a global champion in the planet's favorite sport, nearly 3,000 miles away in Oakland, Major League Cricket determined a winner in the world's second most popular game, cricket. The Seattle Orcas and the five other teams comprising Major League Cricket are all working to advance this global game in America's 50 states. Please let me know if you'd like to connect with Seattle Orcas CEO and former professional fast bowler, Sean Carey. I don't even know how cricket is played.
Yeah, it might be tough.
I like the name the Orcas.
It's a great name
for a team. And I'm giving you some run here, Mark.
Yeah,
but,
you shoot your shot. Yeah, that was
good job out of you.
Yes.
From Matt in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada. Wilbon, I watch soccer to get a pulse on what's happening in the world. Tony, I don't care about the ratings outside the United States because I don't live outside the United States. This is why we listen. From Brian Sunnox. Dear Admiral Tony, on last Wednesday's pod, you mentioned you didn't know which three countries would host the next World Cup. You are slightly mistaken because it will actually be held in three continents.
What?
Argentina, Paraguay, and Uruguay will host one centenary match to honor the 100th anniversary of the first World Cup before the event moves to Spain, Portugal, and Morocco.
Whoa.
It's speculated that FIFA used this format to clear the way for the 2034 World Cup to be held in Saudi Arabia. How many hydration breaks do you think they're going to need there? Yes. From Brendan Borzelli in Lebanon, New Jersey. So Wilbon finds the World Cup finale thrilling, the whole thing riveting. He must have missed the three-game stretch where the Nats gave away leads in the ninth inning at home, dropping all three to the Phillies. The first time in Major League history, a team has gagged up the game in the ninth inning in three straight games. 150-plus years of baseball, the Nats were first to do it. Let's see Argentina pull off that trick. From Dennis Bounds in Redmond, Washington. I looked it up. The pole vault record is held by Sweden's Armando Duplantis, 6.31 meters, 20 feet, Oof. 8 1/4 inches. Oof. 20 feet. I remember when 16 was undoable.
Yeah.
20 feet.
It's remarkable.
Wow. From Fred Unger in Tallahassee, Florida. Tony, you mentioned that no one broke 15 feet in the pole vault till the 50s. I'd like to nominate Dutch Warmerdam as the great, one of the greatest pole vaulters ever. He set a world record of 15 feet, 7 3/4 in 1942 and vaulted over 15 feet 43 times. What makes this almost unbelievable is that he was using a bamboo pole. Fiberglass didn't come into use until the mid-50s. With today's fiberglass poles, he could have easily gone over 20 feet. Well, I don't know about that. But I know that that is true about fiberglass poles, and I'm pretty sure the first person to use it was John Ulsis, who I thought was the first person to go over 16 feet. From Ryan Mills in Greensboro, North Carolina, I think I may have found the source of your golf woes. You've been picking up found feathers on the golf course for good luck all these years? No, no, no. That brings bad luck. What you need to do is stick the feather in the ground as to plant a birdie. Now, I'm not sure if planted birdies experience the same agricultural biology as potatoes and can, in fact, die. So maybe you should bring along a watering can to the course to prevent this. If nothing else, you should hide some go-to breakfast sammies in there. Between this and your potatoes, should be in for a bumper crop this fall. Carla Corrado, and she also sends a picture. We had never met little Tim Raidersdorf when putting out the Dan Byrne is Performing in Town invitation to Aria Littles. He quickly responded, and we secured a number of tickets together. Upon arrival, I called Claire Natola and David Merkowitz that I would wait for this Tim fella in the lobby and go sit down at our table. When they got to the seats, a man introduced himself as Tim, and of course they thought he was the Tim we were meeting. A who's on first situation arose. This Tim was not a little and looked confused when everyone greeted him with a hearty La Cheeseria. For some reason, was offended when offered the TK salute. Needless to say, the misunderstanding was corrected and apologies offered when I walked in with the real Tim Raidersdorf and the stranger Tim realized he'd been seated at the wrong table. Woo! Dan Byrne was delightful. Please see attached photo with Dan Byrne. It's very, very nice. Thank you.
Great?
From Tony T in Brooklyn in D.C. My dad was one of those guys. This is the Knickerbocker Theater. My dad was one of those guys. Every time we drove by, he would point out the block where the Knickerbocker Theater roof collapsed. We'd heard that story.
Yes, we have.
Lyle Graves, Nashville, Tennessee. So the Knickerbocker's collapse was D.C.'s worst theater disaster. I'm sure Ford's theater will be relieved.
Yeah, well, it's not.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that that's shooting probably, Abraham Lincoln
yeah, a little is bit of a bigger deal.
Yeah. John Buchanan in Annapolis, Maryland. For several years in the early 2000s, I worked at an ad agency in Alexandria, Virginia. One of the founders of said agency was Greg Munford. Greg is the voice you hear singing lead on the song Incense and Peppermints. As the story goes, nobody in the band felt the vocals were right for the song, so they asked Greg, a 17-year-old friend of the band, hanging out in the studio that day to give it a shot, and the rest is history. Greg was a pleasure to work for, humble and funny, and went over and above the call of duty when I needed a reference, even many years after leaving the agency. That's a very nice
story.
That
is, yeah.
Dave, who wants to be the robotic surgeon of the podcast, longtime listener, first-time emailer, I bring you greetings from Woodford Park Golf Club in Auckland, New Zealand, where Ryan Fox learned his craft.
Venom.
It's not often New Zealand gets a mention on your show, justifiably. While Ryan may not be a household name in the U.S., he has for a long time carried the flag for New Zealand men's golf around the world with a few wins, including the Canadian Open last year, beating Sam Burns in a playoff. Not only is he a really nice guy, he comes from somewhat sporting royalty here in New Zealand, as we know now.
Yes.
His grandfather captained New Zealand at cricket. His mother was an accomplished tennis player, and his father is one of New Zealand's most famous rugby players and World Cup winner. It's a shame Lydia Ko is not going to the LA Olympics. How about that pair in alternate shot pairs? Anyway, thanks for all the joy you bring. I'd love to host you for a round in New Zealand if you ever come here, although I suspect you're more likely to play golf on the moon than travel this far. From Dave in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Like yourself, I'm a channel flipper. I cannot stand when events are on streaming apps. What provides some solace is Direct TV Stream. While it no longer requires a dish and it is an app, it works like cable where the channels have actual numbers. My Brewers are on 670. I can flip to the local channels as well as having Peacock and Netflix at my fingertip. I pay $120 a month and it will have Red Zone this fall on channel 213. It also has an old school guide with the names of programs, not pictures. Please tell Wilbon to eat it. There's not one sport over the last 25 years where the Milwaukee, Wisconsin team hasn't been more successful. Wilbon hates Philly. I hate Chicago and their whiny fans. From Ron Gujetsky, Hopkins Farm Creamery from Route 9 has opened a shop in Lewis on Savannah Road. Many flavors, including coffee, and the ice cream is yummy.
Well, that's good to know.
I think we have to go find that.
Yeah.
John Donnelly in Enfield, New Hampshire. Which ranks higher on the humiliation hierarchy, sitting on the bacon or flushing the mouse? Flushing the mouse.
You can't do that. Yeah.
And Ted Keniston, Cincinnati, Ohio. I bought a hot dog at the turn at Kiowa's Ocean Course. I teed off on 10 and returned to my car just in time to see a crow fly off with my hot dog. I'll never know if it was still hot or just warm enough. This still haunts me. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, as always, do wear white.
But we don't have the chaputzfa to do it.
There's a lot out by the highway where a lonesome scoreboard stands, like the eyes of Ozymandias overlooks the shifting sands, where there used to be a ballpark. Sounds like an old Sinatra song in an unsentimental number, not some Mitch Miller sing along. The ballpark's only brick and timber. The ballpark's only rust and mold. Never was as big as you remember, though the myth be manifold. Old boys like me, we get nostalgic for old times we never knew, when there were giants in the outfield. Felipe, Matty, J.L.U. And I remember Sam Sosa. And I remember Homer Peel. And I remember Richie Allen. And I wonder how he'd feel. He'd remember that old ballpark, a place where he was cursed and booed for the crime of being uppity, for his immodest attitude. These days we all love Richie Allen. He'd rather that we call him Dick. Finally made it to the Hall of Fame. That SOB was a big stick. We ain't the people of the 60s. We are so much more evolved. We ain't got strife and racial hatred. Buddy, we got those problems solved. Ballpark's only brick and timber. The ballpark's only rust and mold. Never was as big as you remember, though the myth be manifold. There's a gray rain in the Rue de Rivoli. There's a French girl with her head upon my chest. I don't suppose that you'd spare any sympathy for this rich boy's existential unrest. They say the sun sets in Los Angeles. That's where the future crawls ashore. I wasted my youth in Los Angeles, and I hardly ever go there anymore. Left-handedness can be a liability. Play short or third or second base. Baseball's been very, very good to me. I spent my childhood wrapped in her embrace. And it's a long flight from Rossi to Los Angeles. My petite amie scotch and soda when you're in first class. They help you through the dark night of a soul. And I am going back to Los Angeles. I have to check my privilege at the door. Shirley dresses in Los Angeles. That's where the future crawls ashore. Shadow.